welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together, talk about politics, cultural events, and other. Wow. Pretty much know where this is going. If you couldn't tell, I'm Greg Huey.
And I'm Jason Peterson.
Yeah, Jason, we may, this is our Saturday afternoon pod. I think Brandon pulled some childcare duties this afternoon or something. So he's not joining us.
Yeah, we're off to a good start.
As strong as ever.
Yeah.
First thing I want to talk about, one of the topics I kind of found most interesting this week is the Virginia governor's race. And, you know, you just did a quick Google search on this, Jason, and people are portraying this as kind of a first test for Republicans running for a statewide office in kind of a purplish state that is leaning blue in Virginia. This is kind of their first trial run with how to actually run for a statewide office with Trump in play. And I think we got our first kind of set of data points to how they're going to manage that based off of this race.
And since it's purple, I assume that just what it's like to run without Trump in the White House and how you compete and how viable of a candidate you are, that's what this is a measure of, you're saying?
Well, maybe. I guess what we're saying is for 5 years now, or 4 years, we've not seen a person run in the Republican Party without having to deal with Trump in some way, either positively or negatively. So this is the first time he's really going to step directly maybe into a race, or the candidates directly align themselves with him, that he's not president, that he doesn't have the bully pulpit. So that's the first one. How does that look differently? How do people respond differently to it? And secondly, I've never in the history of the United States, I've never recalled a time that an ex-president went to war with his own party.
Right.
I mean, Trump is already, I think on the 30th, he is going to Ohio to do a campaign against Anthony Gonzalez. Anthony Gonzalez is a congressman who voted to impeach him. So while Trump's presence is all over and his thumbprints are all over these candidates, also, too, how effective is an ex-president on the campaign trail in this scenario? I mean, this isn't Bill Clinton going out and making everybody feel good and long for the old days of the Democratic Party. This is still kind of a nuclear option, red hot candidate who still carries a ton of baggage with him.
And this is against the former Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe.
So the governor,
fundraiser of the Democratic Party, right?
So the Virginia governor right now is Robert Northam. You remember him, or Ralph Northam. He's the guy who got in trouble for the blackface scandal.
Okay.
So the person that I despise the most in American politics is Northam's wife, because he had her at the press conference. When the blackface picture came out and there was this first, I don't think that was me, and then it could have been me, and I don't remember it being me. So when you really step in it as a male politician, you have your wife with you. You know, she's always with you to provide support. Right. During his press conference, he basically said that he had put the blackface on because he was dancing like Michael Jackson. And out of nowhere, a reporter asked him, "Can you still do the moonwalk?" And in a moment, he looks around and he kind of moves somebody out of the way. He was actually going to moonwalk. His wife grabs his wrist, looks at him, and is like, "No, what are you doing?" So I don't like his wife because she prevented maybe the greatest moment in political history at a press conference, which would have been the defending governor of Virginia doing the moonwalk to defend him wearing blackface. That was the moment America needed. Anyway, Virginia has some goofy rule where you can't serve back-to-back terms as governor. You can serve multiple terms as governor. You just can't serve back-to-back. So he cannot run again. Okay. The Democrats are running – who won their primary is Terry McAuley. He was a former Democratic governor, very popular in the race. The Democrats choose to have this traditional primary. The Republicans go to this convention. So what is a convention? So the first part is that if you're a registered Republican, you can sign up and register to be a delegate at this convention. So because of the COVID, there were 39 different convention spots along in the state of Virginia where these people met up, debated, and voted for who they wanted to run for governor. So this is a very small pool of registered Republicans who are participating in this process. About 54,000 Republicans in Virginia registered to participate in this delegate process.
Okay, wow. That's, tiny minority, I assume.
Now, the last time they elected a nominee this way through this convention was 2013. They had 8,500 people vote. So think of it this way. All of the registered Republicans in Virginia, I'm going to guess that's probably 2 to 3 million-ish, sure. Something like that.
Sure.
Then you have
8,500 turned out last time.
Then you have 54,000 who registered to participate in this. And the last time they did it, it produced 8,500 votes.
Wow. Talk about your vote making a difference.
So you can certainly see how this narrows by narrowing the population, you narrow the candidates that will run.
Sure.
Because the candidate knows now I have to appeal to a very small slice of registered Republicans that most of them are going to play to the center. This is the way that you eliminate the edges of the of who can be an acceptable candidate within a primary.
Clarify why you think it's people in the center, because when we narrowed that down to 8,500 people, I immediately thought this would be the most passionate subset of the Republican Party, which is probably pretty far to the right, and therefore you'd have somebody trying to appeal to this niche that doesn't carry to the majority. But that doesn't sound like what happened here.
I think that's logical to think that here's how I put this together. So if there's 3 million registered Republicans for easy math in Virginia, only 54,000 of them care enough about this to actually register. There's certainly a logic that those would be the most on fire, to the right, your QAnons, those folks.
Right.
I don't think that happens, because the Republicans kind of make it very clear when you do this process, we are doing this to eliminate the edges.
Okay.
They market this process completely to people who are more maybe veterans within the party, people who understand kind of the party positioning more. And yes, while this could open them up to that small group, I'm pretty sure they contain this and present this and organize this in a way that the Republican Party is basically self-selecting who they're gonna not allow, but who they're gonna promote voting in this primary.
Okay.
And they make it very clear who they want and who they don't want.
This is their attempt at the backdoor dealing in a fairly public, fairly broad way.
Yeah. Think of it this way. Instead of controlling 3 million registered Republicans, we get it down to, like I said, about 8,000.
Yeah.
And we can identify who those 8,000 are by the energy that they give off. Those become apparent who's actually going to get out to vote.
Okay.
So a couple of other interesting things about this. Number one, they counted all of the ballots by hand because multiple candidates refused to participate if they used electronic voting machines due to the high probability of fraud.
Can we just eject those nominees right there then?
It gets better. Multiple nominees even before the results were in, started claiming this was rigged, this was fixed.
Wow.
The party did this intentionally to keep certain people out from getting the nomination.
So is this a preview of what's to come? Are we going to have this sort of fight in every election now going forward on whether the ballots are correctly counted and whether it's automated or by hand, and if something's contested before we even know the answer?
It feels like that's just a standard feature of elections moving forward.
Ugh.
I mean, anything at the state level or federal level feels like that's just a feature now that we're going to have to deal with. So they have all these folks, they go to 39 different, they put them, they take all of the ballots, they securely drive them to a Marriott, and they spend 4 or 5 days going through these ballots. The turnout on this was higher than expected, so I didn't get an actual vote count, but let's just say 12 to 13,000, 14,000-ish people voted for this. So they have to go through all of those votes by hand. At the end of the day, the person, his name is Gary Youngling. His last name gets away from me. But the person that the Republican Party wanted most to win, he's still tied to Trump, but he comes from a business background. I do not believe he's ever held office anymore, but he was the most palatable to run in the general election. He won the primary. So at the end of the day, the Republican Party in Virginia got what they wanted by holding this kind of convention style primary.
So there's a lesson here that there is still the potential to drive the candidate the party wants without overly strong Trump influence if it's in a very controlled fashion and using what sounds like archaic election processes.
Just good old fashioned, you know, browbeating, intimidation, yeah, and telling people you can't do stuff seems to be the way the Republicans went in Virginia. Now, why did they do this? If they wanted someone to win, then they obviously wanted someone to lose. The person who they wanted to lose was Amanda Chase. Amanda Chase is a Virginia state senator who attended the January 6th rally. She did not participate in the insurrection, but she was there for the rally. She describes herself, these are her words, as Trump in heels. In the first round of polling, Jason, she led all contenders. This was, again, registered Republicans with 29% support. The theory is it was that early polling in January and February that made the Republican Party in Virginia get together and say, there is no way we are allowing this chick to run. So they took some control of the brand. They pivot to this convention. When they start polling now people who are registered as delegates, she is dead last. She's a non-factor. Gary Youngland, and I apologize to that gentleman if I'm saying his name wrong, he won fairly comfortably.
Youngkin? Youngkin?
I have Yingling beer on my mind because you don't get Yingling in the Midwest, and it kind of aggravates me. But the moral of the story is that the Republican Party saw data, they went a different route, and they managed to exert control over an election process to get the candidate they want, who they feel will perform best in the general election. I think this is the wave of the future.
Okay, so let's say that is this convention process that you described. Does it exist in other states already? Because I assume one of the advantages here of Virginia is this was a thing already on the books, already practiced, and they knew how to. I want to use the word manipulate. They knew how to game it, right? If this process doesn't exist in other states, then they got to try something different in each one.
Yeah, how a party does the primary is really up to the party. I think almost every state will allow the party to go about picking who they want in any way that they wish. It's just there was a huge push, I believe, back into the 90s where let's get out of this smoke-filled room. We're getting candidates that don't connect with the people. And that's why they went back to this primary process. Now they're saying we get people that connect a little bit too well with the people. That are not pretty much dialed into the party and what the party wants. And I think this is their way of kind of taking that back.
What's the next big primary to watch? Do you know? Would we see something similar play out?
So the next big primary for Democrats, and this one unfortunately is just for Democrats, is the New York City mayoral race. this is really, really interesting. So Andrew Yang was leading that race, leading it a lot, I think, on name recognition that he gained from his presidential run, was popular with progressives. But there's another candidate, Adam, and I cannot think of his name, who is gaining on him. And he is a more of a traditional law and order, middle of the road, non-progressive, blue dog, traditional Democrat. And the big thing that's going, what's going to be interesting here is where Yang is pigeonholed more of a, as a progressive. I don't really know if that's his policy. How is that going to play with voters? Are voters going to gravitate to the law and order? We need to get this under control. Yes, there has been a spike in crime. The defund police stuff was idiotic from day one. This is now our next version of what that is. So it'll be interesting to see if he can pull that off.
And that'll be playing out, obviously, on the left side then. So,
yeah. Hmm. And Yang got in trouble the other day during a debate for giving what I thought was the greatest answer to the homeless situation I've ever heard a politician give, where he basically said it's immoral to let people live on the streets. It's not fair to those people. It's not fair to the people in those neighborhoods. The character of that city is being changed by violence and homelessness. And what Andrew Yang basically said is this is a mental health problem. This is a drug problem. And we're just going to start building mental health beds and facilities so we can get these people off the street and get them help. And I thought that was pretty straightforward.
What was the reaction to that?
He got criticized because they felt that was too – he wasn't being empathetic enough. He wasn't recognizing the rights of the homeless people, that they could just be routed up. They could be herded up and, you know, herded into mental health facilities. It's that type of liberal progressive thinking that's gotten us in the problem that we've gotten.
Yeah, here you at least have somebody trying to problem solve for it then.
And my question is always, if that's not the answer, then – please tell me, what it is.
Yeah.
Because that feels like the best one anybody's come up with.
It's the same. That was the same thing with healthcare. It's like people complained for decades about redoing healthcare. Finally, something comes along and the alternative was non-existent. So, and I bring that up because I saw that there was a Supreme Court vote last week that upheld a part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. This is that part that you can – that the law – they were trying to kick out the mandate. They've gone at the mandate multiple times that if the mandate wasn't there, the whole law must go.
Yeah,
I think this was finally the Supreme Court saying, don't come back. We've done this three times. We're done.
Yep. Yeah. And so I think somebody – maybe it was Obama whose quote was, once it's passed, you know, once legislation's on the books, it's really hard to get rid of. And that seems to be proven over and over again with this one at least.
Something of that size and scope, once it goes in, it's very difficult to yank that out.
Yeah.
And it's popular.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting education there, Craig. Thank you.
You said you had some big tech laws that passed this week that you were looking at.
Yeah, sure. So let's cover that for a second. So we might remember that a couple months ago, Congress held a bunch of hearings and paraded out all the leadership of Apple and Google and Facebook and Amazon, and they testified and they grilled them with lots of questions, but it never really went anywhere. Well, it seems like there is finally some movement on takeaways from that. And incredibly, another case of bipartisan support, there were four bills dropped on Friday that are all tailored around handling this big tech problem and how to rein some of these companies in. And of course, there's different definitions on what that means, but the carve out is almost exclusively focused on Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple.
Yeah.
What they use is terms around market cap, it being an online platform, the number of simultaneous users, how much revenue goes in through products and services, that kind of thing. Basically, the reason why they have all these different niche definitions is so they can leave out your Visas and your JP Morgan Chase, all these huge banks that would otherwise be similar size as far as revenue and influence and how they merge and acquire and such. And so they're concretely trying to carve it out for tech, but there are four different bills. I can cover a couple of interesting bits from a few of them. The first one is the American Innovation and Choice Online Act, which, again, bipartisan, somebody from a Democrat from Rhode Island and Gooden, a Republican from Texas. And it covers any platform that tries to give an advantage to its own products and services, which is all of these, right? So it explicitly it has rules against anti-steering. And a great example of that is when you use Netflix on Apple's devices. Of course, Netflix doesn't want to pay Apple 30% of your $10 a month fee. So they don't want to run their credit card transactions through Apple's platform. They want to run it through their own website. Well, Apple has rules in place that prevent Netflix from directing you to their own website to charge your subscription revenue on there. And that's called a steering provision. And so there's anti-steering stuff in there. Spotify complains about that a lot too. It's gotten so bad on the Apple platform that Spotify and Netflix can't even tell you to go to their website to pay for the subscription. So if you download it and try to sign in, it's just like, hey, you have to make an account somewhere else. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. It's really dumb. Then there's also a lot about how the business can control pricing, you know, what percentages they might be able to take, how they can explicitly restrict interoperability with other platform owners, et cetera. Another really interesting one that I think would impact not just these big tech companies, but anybody trying to merge and acquire, the Platform Competition and Opportunity Act comes from Jeffries in New York and Buck in Colorado, again, a Democrat and Republican. And it bans acquisitions by these companies unless the acquiring company can prove either there's no potential provided competition, the platform doesn't compete anyway, or my favorite, it does not enhance the platform's offering in any way, which would basically just like, what's the point of acquiring them, right? And the carve out, or the reason why this bill even exists is the Facebooks of the world buying like an Instagram, right? Instagram could have had a very successful platform on its own. Facebook bought it up. Yeah. Now you're not going to go share photos anywhere else. There's some more language around monopolies and in particular trying to charge extra money for filing fees and such so they can actually ramp up the whatever the bureaucracy is that looks at mergers and acquisitions and passes them. Apparently they've been underfunded and that's the kind of thing that'll cover that. And then there's legislation that tries to reduce the burden from switching services. So roughly those four different buckets, you know, we'll see how far this goes. But I think you can see the kind of wolves circling and the fact that it's bipartisan and the fact that we just keep hearing noise about how to rein in big tech. Something's coming. And I think what I'll be most interested to see, call it this summer, would be do these tech companies do they become proactive enough to change their software or their hardware or their rules in such a way as to prevent legislation from coming? You know, yeah. Apple could change their app store tomorrow anytime they wanted and maybe head some of this stuff off. And of course, these tech platforms are going to dig their heels in and try not to have to change anything. It seems pretty clear legislation's coming. How far it goes, I don't know. I think, one other interesting one that I forgot to mention. And the reason I mentioned this one is because this is where the danger of legislation actually can impact you, the user, in a negative way. You know, in the spirit of a lot of this is supposed to improve competition, therefore improve the platform and make it a better, more, usable experience for us as end users. But one of the carve outs for a company like Apple or Google tries to limit defaulting the applications that they can have on their phones. Mm-hmm. And you might recognize a very similar parallel to what happened to Microsoft back when they bundled Internet Explorer. And, you know, they got hammered hard. Internet Explorer left. And then it did work in the sense that the browser market opened up. Chrome came around. Firefox came around, etc. Well, imagine going to buy your Google Pixel or your Apple iPhone, and it doesn't have a mail application. It doesn't have a browser application. It doesn't have a music application. You know, Spotify wants to be on there, not Apple's or whatever. You know, on the surface, you can understand why if it's a clear playing field, somebody else gets on there. But at the same time, if your parent goes to buy a phone and they have no idea how to download any of these things and set these up, and now the phone's useless, it doesn't do anything. So
can you buy, like he said, you could buy the parent package, the student package, the advanced user package. If you paid for it, would they put them back on just for convenience?
We'll see what the legislation ultimately says, but it seems like a very fine line to walk there to make that service useful that you just purchased.
So the mergers and acquisition thing is interesting. So I don't think I've worked for a tech company in the last 15 years that had any interest in making money or being a viable standalone business. And I think this is the part that a lot of people about the tech companies, the smaller tech companies, don't get. Most companies are started to be sold. You don't really have a desire. No, nobody's making the next IBM. Nobody has a, wow, in 10 years, no one's building a legacy company to pass to their family. It's how quickly can we either do tech that attracts a buyer or gain a user base that we can sell the user base, not the tech. So are those rules of the game fundamentally changing now?
I think they definitely want to influence that. And, you know, right now the language is such a way that it only is applied to these really huge companies. But, you know, to your point, traditionally somebody wanted to sell their tech company right away, either because they're looking for the cash payout or, you know, in a less nefarious purpose, maybe they just acknowledge it's really hard to grow a company organically that big. But you know, if you lop off the tops of the heads here, so Facebook can't do it, Apple can't do it, Google can't do it, Amazon can't do it. I suppose the best case is medium to small size companies could still purchase, acquire, merge, et cetera. Yeah. But these big dogs can't come in and take you and take up some feature function that you developed that they don't have, and therefore just destroy all competition at the same time.
And is Apple basically saying, if you're on my device and you collect fees in any way, I'm going to get a piece of that, period?
That's right. So originally, Apple just charged 30% off of anything you bought in the App Store if you downloaded it. And later it became, you know, heavily involved in subscriptions. You know, if you spend $9.99 a month on Amazon Prime or Netflix, they wanted 30% of that. Well, the bigger the company came in, the more controversy there was, right? Amazon wasn't going to keep paying 30% of every book they sold. And so they went to court over that one. And it's just actually come out this spring that Amazon did give favorable treatment to the big dogs.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe Amazon only got charged Apple gave favorable treatment to the big dogs, and maybe they only charged 10% for Amazon. And meanwhile, their public face to the whole developer world was that this everybody's treated the same. The rules are applied the same for everybody. So, you know, in parallel to all this court case drama that's going on, some of these companies, Apple in particular, just last week they had their worldwide developer conference. They've got a huge, you know, call it developer relation problem. And their approach is, we built this platform and, you know, you should all thank us for providing this means to have a career and build a company. And while that's true, it can also be true that really great applications that were developed for it made the iPhone appealing and therefore successful. It's a little more symbiotic, and, you know, Amazon and Netflix can be cozy with Apple versus the 99% of the other people trying to make, you know, your game or whatever on there are largely responsible for the success of it as well.
And wasn't that one of Apple's biggest early market mistakes, is that Windows, it was for free to like license their core stuff to write Windows applications. But Apple, you had to pay a fee, right? Wasn't there like a $10,000 or some, there was some fee that was very prohibitive, just keeping developers from writing against the Apple OS.
Yeah. I don't know what the fee was at first, but it actually still exists today. You have to pay $100 a year.
Okay.
Which, you know, one time doesn't sound bad, but year after year after year, you know, and that's the other, that's only kind of the surface level of what you have to spend, because if you want to develop for the Apple platform, you also have to do it on Apple hardware. So now you're, you know, buying a $2,000 laptop and whatever else. The same cannot be said for Google or for Microsoft, which is more open in that sense.
And I kind of side with, at least I can see Apple's side of this. If I'm Apple, I'm looking at the developer community saying, hey guys, 80% of the problem I solved. I created a mobile distribution network. Then I got the world addicted to it so you could write apps for it. This is not a weighted relationship at all. And by the way, there's only a few entities that could pull off the building the global infrastructure for the iPhone. Yeah. There's 16-year-old kids in Taiwan that write killer apps.
Yeah.
So at some point, I understand the developer community's point, but I think they're, and just from a sheer power position, Apple's got so much going for it at this point.
Yeah. Well, and at this point, you know, Apple, as successful as they are selling hardware, they want to also be a services business. And for the health of their business in the long term, they want to show that that grows. Well, guess what? A big chunk of the services business is, it's not just the fees charged to developers, but it's that 30% nick they take out of everything being sold. It's many, many billions of dollars now. And while they still have to maintain, you know, a lot of the infrastructure on credit card handling and, you know, application marketing and that kind of stuff, there are expenses around that. Now, where I think they can maybe get into a little bit more trouble, and some of this legislation covers, is that's fine if they come off as this neutral platform that, you know, they're taking their fee because they have expense to support this, but at the same time they'll be advertising their own products, and they'll you know, change how the search algorithms work to prioritize their stuff over somebody. You know, Apple Music's going to come up first if you search for music, not Spotify or not Amazon Music or whatever. I'm just saying,
Jason, give me your definition of a neutral platform.
A neutral platform, I suppose, it would be the one where you're just collecting money to cover your expenses plus some profit margin. So if you're the credit card handler, you're taking credit cards, you're processing those fees, maybe you're storing them for recurring charges, but you're not being an arbiter of what makes a good application. You're not evaluating, you know, which application is better than another for a photography app or something like that. Now, Apple also, you know, good or bad, they curate the store. So there used to be 1,000 flashlight apps, you know, they got rid of all that stuff. But at the same time, there's a lot of spammy stuff out there too. And sometimes even in the top 10 apps, there'll be something that has, you know, a recurring subscription of $10 a week. And it's just in super micro print. And, you know, your grandmother can't figure that out while she's downloading it. Before you know it, she's paying forever on it.
When you unbox your new iPhone, should it be a completely blank slate? Should there be nothing on it? And then you choose what you put on?
That would have been the traditional hardware approach, right? I built this computer, which, let's acknowledge, an iPhone is a computer. I built this computer, you bought it, and maybe it's got the OS on it, but that's it. Nowadays, that's not what a user expects. If you buy a phone or a tablet or a computer, you want to open it up and listen to music and do your word processing and surf the web and word processing. Man, nobody probably, we're old when we say that.
I was going to say, you kind of aged both of us there, Jason, word processing. Yeah. If you say word perfect next, we should just end the podcast. Remember word perfect? Who thought that was a good idea?
Oh, there were some quality DOS applications back in the day. They're just gone now. Anyway, I think this is kind of interesting how it influences market dynamics and what happens with competition. And, you know, we'll see over time if this quote unquote bipartisan reining in of the big tech continues to occur. And maybe that's our infrastructure bill. Now it's all online infrastructure. Yeah.
But wouldn't you, if you're big tech, wouldn't you just look right at Congress and say, what do you people want? In 15 years, we worked out a business model that put a supercomputer in the pocket of every human being on this planet. And that supercomputer only has access to humans' knowledge in total. And we have found a model that every can afford it. Anybody who wants one has one, and it's continuously improved. what is exactly your complaint again? Yeah. Where did we go wrong? Are you telling us we're too successful? Are you saying you don't want this? I think that's the other side too, is what do we want out of these new laws?
Well, and the language of these laws, we use the word monopoly a lot. It's not a monopoly. Worst case, there's a duopoly, right? But you do have a choice. You can pick which platform you want to buy and which one you want to support. Now, there's the whole vendor lock-in concern and all that kind of stuff. But others have come and gone, right? If you look around the U.S., I think the iPhone outsells Google by quite a margin. But if you look at the globe as a whole, it's the complete opposite. Yeah. So, it's easy to point a finger at Apple locally, but they still have quite a lot of competition globally.
Yeah, I think if I'm the tech people, I just ask Congress the question we asked on the first segment. If not this, what? If you don't like this model because you feel are we too powerful? We have too many, whatever that is. Okay. If you don't like that, how else can we do this?
Yeah.
Because I was at the AT&T store talking to a gal who'd worked for AT&T for like 23 years. And she's like, we could end all this data sharing stuff immediately. That your phone's $4,000 now. Is that what you want? I mean, part of this is we're kind of going along with this too, to get the products and services at a price that we want it to be at.
Yeah, there is an element of that for sure.
I'd love to take all of these laws, put them in effect, fast forward 25 years and look at unintended consequence. Because I have a feeling these laws are going to come off the books very quickly.
Well, and it does make you worry that are there enough – if you're going to legislate tech companies, are there enough tech people, or at least people who understand what it means to have anti-steering laws on a phone? Like it's not like you're legislating big oil or railroads anymore. It's very different. No.
Yeah. You're trying to get a rein on three guys in a basement writing code, creating features now that you're saying a big company wouldn't be interested to buy. That changes the whole model. Speaking of changing models, another topic I wanted to talk about. I wasn't going to bring this one up, but Brandon's not here, so we've got another slot to fill. Did you see that Victoria's Secrets, the Victoria's Secrets company, they are completely changing their branding and their image?
So I saw something about this flip on the headline, and I'll admit I didn't open it yet because I was like, what is that about? And I didn't have time to go back to it. So here's another one. I'll be anxious to hear and learn from you what's going on with Victoria's Secret.
So the reason I'm so fascinated with this is number one, when you work in a lot of tech companies, you work at a lot of small companies that are trying to attract revenues and money. You're always in this state of, we need more financing to hire more people, to build more product, to attract the bigger company that we want to buy us. That it's this dance constantly. And you're never really making a ton. You're always kind of dancing down this razor's edge of when things are going to fall apart on you. So my fascination with how that logic applies to Victoria's Secret. So we find the four corners here. Victoria's Secrets is part of L Brands. L Brands owns Bath and Body Works, and I think a couple of other retail establishments. They do about $12 billion in business a year. That is a non-trivial sum. Out of that, Victoria's Secrets accounts for about $5 billion. And of that $5 billion, they run a profit of $888 million. So just so we get an idea of what a giant Victoria's Secrets and L Brands is, it's always interesting when you walk people through that store you see at the Legends that you know it's part of this massive entity that has a global reach
that makes almost $1 billion in cash a year.
Think about that. Almost $1 billion in cash a year that brand Victoria's Secrets makes. Okay. So just so we all set level with each other moving forward, Victoria's Secret sells lingerie to men and they use sexual images of women to sell it. I think Victoria's Secret has been around enough. I don't think that's surprising anybody to say that they're using sex to sell, and Victoria's Secret sells lingerie to men. That's their core business. Even with those numbers, 2 years ago, they decided we're going to have to change. If we don't change, we're going to get flat-footed and we're going to get left behind. So 2 years ago, they stopped doing the angel runway shows. Okay. These are the shows with the models that wear the wings. Jason, I'm old enough to remember when those were actual pay-per-view events that you could you could buy. They stopped doing those. They spin Victoria's Secrets off into its own brand. And then this week, they announced that they are doing no more lingerie models. They are completely refocusing their brand. They're bringing in women like Megan Rapinoe and Nick Jonas's wife. She's Indian. She's an actress. I could try to pronounce her name, but I would destroy it. They're bringing in more activists, more socially aware, more mature, more realistic, more professional women that they are going to start being the marketing face for Victoria's Secrets. Some of these women are also going to join the board. So they are going to get really involved with running Victoria's Secrets. Why this is so fascinating to me, Jason, is number one, with the whole woke culture finding its way into corporate America, what am I looking at? Is this the most woke culture example that has manifested itself so far? Or is this a group of people looking into the future, looking at data and making the rational decision that something's got to change? I get it. We're $5 billion in revenue. We're sitting on $1 billion of cash. But
that's not enough.
That doesn't matter. We've got to change. And the reason I think I'm so fascinated with that is I've never worked for an organization. Now, the scales are very lower that has any amount of strategic ability that we would even talk or consider this. If things were going that good, it's fascinating to me that they're saying, yes, it's good now. It's still going to be good in 5 years, still going to be good in 10 years, but maybe in 15 or 20. They're seeing the writing on the wall and they're trying to make a strategic move.
They don't want to cash cow it.
I guess I've never met people that don't want a cash cow. Might be my problem. But and two, this is an American brand. They have invested billions of dollars and decades of time, energy, and effort to build a brand that can sell at that clip and make that kind of money. And now they're taking the risk of massively pivoting that brand.
So it sounds like what you're saying is they're going to stop targeting men.
That's what they're doing. So there is I did some Googling on lingerie this week. I called my daughter a couple of times.
I'm sure she was glad to hear you talk about that.
Oh, yeah. She really loves when I've called her and say, I have a question about lingerie. So Victoria's Secret is starting to lose market share to two specific companies. And again, I'm going to butcher these and get these wrong. One of them is Fenty. Fenty is started or affiliated with Rihanna. And they started marketing lingerie towards women. So this whole industry got disrupted when companies came along and changed who they were actually marketing their product to. And now Victoria's Secrets, the biggest player in here, is going to try to make a similar attempt to redo their branding, their marketing, and their messaging and reinvent themselves as a company that sells to women, not men.
I suppose there are more women who buy women's clothes than men who buy women's clothes.
At a simple, basic level, that sounds 100% right, I would think.
Well, if you're doing math over 10 years, I guess I see it.
As the father of a daughter, anything that reduces the amount of sexual images used at young women and women in general in advertising, I'm all for.
Yeah, me too.
If this just eliminates a few commercials, I'm all good with that. But my fascination point is this wokeism going amok? Are they just trying to jump early? What are they trying to do?
Is this a financial argument or a cultural argument? Are they adapting because the culture has changed, or are they really looking at this like this is some sort of financial danger in the future? My guess is it's the former. So. That's
number
really
one, when you're making $1 billion in profit, that's a really hard argument to make that you're facing enough jeopardy that you need to completely change your marketing and your advertising and your branding.
Imagine those board meetings. You sit down, you look at the revenue numbers for 2021 and say, nope, we're throwing it all out the door.
You know, we didn't hit we almost got to $1 billion. And okay, so there's that. And then there's what is this calculation they're making? What is the upside? If they pivot to this market for marketing more to women, is that a bigger market? are there more women interested in buying their product than men? So some just from a sheer product perspective, what are they looking at that thinks this move is even possible?
Yeah. It also feels like even if they're right in their math and their cultural direction change, it would take a long time to do a rebrand that significant for something that changes its imagery to such a degree.
And you're going to have to walk that through, to your point, that brand's going to have to sit for years in the market to change kind of the imagery we associate with Victoria's Secrets.
Yeah.
So where this is interesting to me is, one, I'm always fascinated when people, how did you project in the future? What data set did you see? What facilitated this move? And then this has the added kind of intrigue of, is this the biggest example of a company kowtowing to woke culture? Did they come out and basically say, we don't want to do this, but we see the writing on the wall, we're going to have to. The market shifted from us and we were responding to it.
And it'll be a really interesting marketing case study, because at the end of the day, they're selling the same product. They're just going to market it differently, right? They're probably still using the same fabrics, the same manufacturing places and locations and people.
And you're not selling it to a tangential audience. You're selling it to the complete opposite side of the coin. As a man, I could probably list four or five things that I would like in that product. As a woman, probably wouldn't match up at all with what the woman sees. So just from a sheer trying to completely reinvent yourself quickly, this is going to be interesting to watch.
I'll keep an eye out for that one, because I did see a headline on it maybe just 2 days ago, and I thought, oh, weird, I haven't heard about that brand in a while, and then moved on.
So we're recording this on America's first Juneteenth. I think that's awesome that the holiday got extended from out of Texas to everybody.
Anything? And it all happened signed Friday, right?
Yeah, happened pretty quickly.
Very small number of Republicans that did not vote for it, and it passed the House and the Senate, went straight to getting signed, and it did it buyer on the actual day.
I think 14 Republicans didn't sign on this in the House. And these
I feel like there's this game here for a couple weeks ago. You're like, let's start guessing. Green, Gohmert.
You know? There were some people again. We have too many national holidays already. Did you know every national holiday costs $2.6 billion in productivity? Blah, blah, blah. We already have the 4th of July. It's a unifying holiday. This isn't unifying because, I mean, all of the things you would expect came out.
Yeah. Well, so some of this was, there were people concerned that if Juneteenth became a federal holiday, July 4th wouldn't, like, which is just asinine. But, you know,
if we fast forward
3 weeks, we'll learn that did not happen.
I think anybody making that argument that's not a good faith argument to make. They just don't like the holiday and just want to, they don't want to say that. So they just want to say, we have too many, or it's the 4th or whatever. Yeah. But
so do you think that if this is a federal holiday that, Will it always be on a Saturday, or is it only June 19th? Or, like, actually, I'm not sure on that.
My understanding is it's always going to be the 19th. So we could get a day off to work for this in the next year or so.
Well, and so then would it become an observed one, where if it lands on a Saturday, Friday is observed or whatever, you know?
So where my wife works, they took a half day off
on
Friday because it landed on a Saturday. So it feels like this is going to become a fully functional national holiday.
May people acknowledge what it means when it comes, then.
And anybody thinks we don't have enough holidays, we get off work, they can.
Yeah, but that seems like a weird thing to complain about. We don't need more time off.
I saw this thing this week where, let me get these numbers right, 81% of people surveyed wanted to quit their current job, and 61% of people surveyed wanted to change industries, do something totally and completely different.
That has to be a direct result of sitting at home for a year and thinking about what they like and don't like, right? I mean,
that's the theory is you've got the informational workers that sat in their basement for a year and a half and spent the time just thinking, why am I doing this? Why am I here? What's going on? And then you have non-informational workers that were forced to work through all of this. And they're thinking, well, what am I doing here? This is silly. I think everybody kind of got a feel for, you know, maybe what the relationship with work really is in this country. I don't know. I think, yes, this, to answer your question, this feels like it's a direct response of people sitting for a year and a half thinking, what am I doing?
So the percentage of people that wanted to change industries, do you know if the majority of them were in a certain industry like retail or like, I'm assuming it's not the information worker that wants to change industry. It's probably somebody who was stuck doing whatever they were doing during COVID and didn't want to, you know, hey, it's a pandemic and I'm here serving you at a restaurant or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it got into those numbers, but the theory that she wanted to kind of keep an eye on is this going to hold? How long are people going to feel this way? And I think it's fairly easy to say right now, workers feel empowered. The ball is in their court.
Yeah.
When we hit July, when we hit September, when benefits run out, and by then employer is going to almost demand that they're back.
Yeah.
Does this kind of resistance movement mentality still hold?
Well, I think you just hit part of it too, which is this is probably the early part of the storm, because this fall, you know, August, September, when schools are back and everybody's asked to return to work, which from my understanding around the metro area, especially in the tech area, most businesses have picked dates in August and September to return. That's when the proof's really going to land, because when people start that commute again and they're back full time in the office, are they happy or not?
It's easy to say, I'm not going to do it when you still have a job.
Yeah.
When the decision is you do it or you don't have a job, that makes it a little bit different. Did you watch any of Biden and Putin's whatever that was this week?
I read the summary of it and I saw, you know, Biden stating for the umpteenth time from every president as a predecessor, you know, you're not going to get away with doing anything bad. Yes. I'm like, okay, well, I think we've seen otherwise.
It's like Putin was like, you little rascal. And we topple his hair and it's like, you just stop being such a knucklehead. And he just does whatever he wants.
Yeah.
Just real quickly. So Russia's like national GDP is $1.7 trillion. That puts them in the 20s when it comes to ranking their economic output. Italy is 1.4, for example. We make fun of the Italians all the time because they're old and their economy sucks.
Well, and Russia's primary output is still oil, right?
Oil and natural gas. Just to put that into perspective, the output of the United States is about $22 trillion.
Wow.
So Russia has about the same economic output as Texas. And this is always the complaint. Why are we being on a stage with him? Why are we even over there? What do we get out of this? Great. We told him to stop. Like, you know, we handed him a list apparently of targets. Okay. That's dumb. I just don't know, as America, what do we get out of this? I wasn't 100% sure.
So it's still military strength, right? That's why he's still on the stage. That's why they're still such an adversary. And that's why you got to sit next to him. And it's not just the bomb. It's the traditional measure of a military, because Texas doesn't have a military. Italy doesn't have that kind of military, right?
But I think we still think of them as the Soviet Power. Union. And it was interesting too, is that we brushed up against letting Ukraine into NATO. That's we got to put some real thought into that, because that might not be what we want to do.
Well, it wasn't part of this whole European tour to kind of shore up support of the G7 before the meeting with Russia. So like, hey, look, whatever craziness you want to think of as the last 4 years, all this traditional NATO group is still aligned and we're going to recommit to defending one another, et cetera. And then you go meet the guy who is presumably still orchestrating certain attacks and try to present this united front. But if you really don't have a way to defend yourself on it, you know, this topic still drives me nuts.
And I don't think they defined any hard set. Hey, these are repercussions if this doesn't stop.
Well, if Russia lobs a missile to, you know, Belgium, then the whole NATO is going to come to their defense. But if they go knock out their train system, is anything going to happen? No.
And remember, like, 2 or 3 years ago when Putin made this big deal about they had supersonic missiles and stuff like that? It's like, if you're going to go to war, it's not going to be with missiles. It's going to be with what you're doing right now internationally, or small regional conflicts with Ukraine and Crimea. So yeah, you, the fact that you have a supersonic missile, great. I don't know what that means. And you're right. I think we're just completely out of whack with what Russia is right now.
And how safe do you feel? Like, I'm not worried about supersonic missiles, but know what? I actually do think there's a reasonable chance somebody could take out the power grid in the metro area if they wanted, right?
The Texas power grid exploding is much more of a concern than a Russian supersonic missile hitting the United States.
Yeah.
And we just can't seem to make that pivot.
Do you see California is in another big drought? And there's I just read this morning, I'm going to forget the name of it, but there's some famous water plant that's going to have to shut down because the reservoir level is so low. And it's going to be the first time since the 60s that it won't be able to generate power, and it generates power for like 800,000 homes.
I thought that like California, the mountains and stuff, got so much snow and rain that like always produced enough water for the population there.
And I think traditionally that would have been held true, but the last 10 years, no. I don't think there's enough snow in the winter, and there's not enough rain in the spring. And so the sea level of all the different reservoirs that they measure, that they're either pumping water to for electricity or for dams or whatever, just keeps going down. Meanwhile, everything stays dry and you've got fire hazards. And my company, we have people that work out in a couple different areas of California, especially in Northern California. And it's every year between now and August is just like a nail biter of, are we going to have employees evacuate? When we had an office out there, they'd have to leave the office because there'd be too much smoke in the air.
When does the government of California just say about 8 million people need to move? We're going to give you a year or two to do it on your own. But one of our core problems, we just got too many people here. The population's just – it's just too much.
Well, and when you have a region that seems so susceptible to climate change, there's not a whole lot they can do to control global climates, right? No. And they're so susceptible to a downswing there. Even if you don't believe it's permanent, you know, and if it's just a 10 or 20 years – 20-year swing, that's a pretty massive impact.
I mean, California seems like it's been on this 10-year decline, and it just doesn't seem like there's any real path forward to get out of it. I don't think electing Caitlyn Jenner governor would help, which that was a joke because she's a joke as a candidate, and that's just a joke. And hey, California, if you want to be more of a joke, that would be a way to make yourself more of a joke. But I'm not sure what – with the amount of people they have out there, with the demand that they have on resources, I don't know what the answer is to make that better.
When is Newsom's term up? Do you know?
I know in November, the recall election will probably take place somewhere around October or November, because it takes a good 6 months to get this thing organized to go. So he's gonna have that at the end of the year. And then I want to say 2022, I think he has to turn right back around and do a general election at that point. So I don't know. But the recall election should flush out any serious GOP candidate. At least you're going to see who it is, and he may take another crack at him at the general, but that whole special election is just going to be an absolute shit show. Just a joke. And the way they do it's just so stupid. That's the only thing they're going to get. So
Craig, I think it was a week ago, you were giving me crap for not having any time to read. And I had something on the list from on the wish list at the library for, I don't know, months. And it happened to come up like right after you said that. So I got it and I read it this week. And so now I can tell you, I just finished a book.
An actual paper page turning book?
Yeah, an actual paper page turning book. What's funny is it's a fiction novel about a pandemic. It's called The End of Men.
Why? And
this gal apparently wrote this before the pandemic, but it got released during the pandemic. And this particular virus in the novel only impacts men, and the mortality rate's extremely high. So there's a little bit of buildup of, you know, the thing spreading or whatever, and them trying to find a vaccine and whatnot. And then it pivots to what's life afterwards when there's only 10% of people are male. And I'm, you know, probably a feminist novel's dream or whatever, but it's kind of interesting from how they predicted things would turn out. It was a pretty quick page turner too for being a pandemic novel. So that was my read for the last week or two.
as soon as you said like 10% of males are left, my first thought was that would be awesome to be in that 10%. And then 5 seconds later, it's like, wow, I really hope I die in the initial blast from the vaccine, because that sounds terrible.
Well, one of the things that highlighted early on is how many critical jobs are mainly provided by men. And you know, even something like trash pickup. Like,
danger jobs.
Yeah, a lot of danger jobs, police, you know, military, et cetera. And but the one that illustrated well was like the trash thing, which you just really don't think about much. But if trash quits getting picked up, pretty soon you have a huge sanitary problem, and then it's leaking in the water, and it's just this.
How many things would change overnight that if men stopped leading them and the entire leadership became women?
Well, yeah.
What wouldn't be completely changed?
So imagine China run by women and the Communist Party run by women instead. That's like a chapter in this book. I mean, if this kind of wondering aloud makes you curious, you should check it out. But I mean, there's something to be said for if the male dominance isn't in every single industry and how these things are built and governed, what would be different?
If there were a virus that were specifically killing men, I would just lock myself in the house and relax and not give it a second thought, because I know in a month they're going to cure that thing. Every possible resource that could be marshaled to correct that would be, and I think we'd get that done pretty quickly.
It took like 18 months in the book, and that was enough time for it to pretty much spread everywhere.
What would the difference in response to viruses be globally for one that killed women and one that killed men? Because
there's like an overabundance of men in microbiology and, you know, whatever virus researchers exist, that kind of stuff. And so
that's true.
One of the stories was trying to isolate the scientists in that so that they could work on the cure. Because, of course, if they all die, then there are obviously plenty of women in there. There just aren't as many. And therefore, you know, traditional STEM problem, right? Like, how do you get more women into science, technology, engineering, and math?
I just think of President Trump during one of those press conferences, that he'd be really good at handling the nuances that we have to treat men differently. The sexes are going to be treated differently. I'm sure that's something he could articulate, get everybody on board with. And as Americans, that would have made the problem worse if the virus were gender specific. Yeah, we could.
Yeah, it doesn't instill much confidence in how we handle that.
Well, I'm glad that you got time to read a book. I wasn't making fun of you for not reading. It was your schedule doesn't permit that as much as other folks do.
It probably helped a little bit that my wife and daughter were out of town at this dance thing in Missouri. So my son and I were bacheloring it. And I can only grill hot dogs so many times before I'm like,
I would have picked a more happy book, because that book sounds like it's like.
Like I said, it just came up on I can't remember what you call that. When you go to you get the little wish list on the library, you reserve it or whatever. And every once in a while I'll see something like, oh, that looks interesting. I'll put it on there. And then like 3 months later, I was at the back of the list and it comes up.
I've started no new reads, no new listens. It's college moving time for kids. Tuesday, I got to move my son into his third story apartment, which was just awesome. And then in like 2 weeks, I have to go back down and move my other kids. So this next 2 weeks is all about getting the kids situated in college.
Driving, packing, unpacking.
And I try to remind my son, we're going to do this at least 3 more times in your college career. So when you buy stuff, make sure you're okay if we just throw it away instead of moving.
Do you remember when you could like fit everything in your car?
Hell yeah.
It was awesome.
Times without.
Yeah, I'd like bounce between apartments because like rent would drop down $50 and 6 months later be like, I'm out of here now.
Multiple times. Me and my roommate just pulled a couch out of the dumpster, called it good. And for the next 8 months, that's where we lived.
Yeah.
Like I said, until somebody gave a $50 special to move in somewhere else. And we did that all the time.
That one's got a pool. Let's go over there. It takes a day to pack.
Apartment expectations among college kids has increased exponentially from when I was there. So they like some more modern amenities than I think maybe you and I were used to.
I think they've redone all the dorms and stuff now too, right? They're like, you know, like mini suites now.
they've got the concept of there's like a common room and then there's rooms off of that and they share bathrooms and they're really nice. But it's like, again, you hit some of those that look like they're modern apartments that you wouldn't mind living in. And then there's some other hall that was built in 1952 out of cinder blocks that just, you know, looks like every kid in Missouri has, you know, had a nosebleed in this dorm room at some point. So I guess my point is, yeah, some dorm rooms are really nice. Some are just absolutely gross.
I've got a couple more years before I have to worry about that.
But. Oh, it's great. All righty. Let's end it there. Thanks, Jason. Right.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.